The Island of Missing Trees by Elif Shafak. Prologue. Island. Once upon a memory, at the far end of the Mediterranean Sea, there lay an island so beautiful and blue that the many travellers, pilgrims, crusaders, and merchants who fell in love with it either wanted never to leave or tried to tow it with hemp ropes all the way back to their own countries. Legends, perhaps. But legends are there to tell us what history has forgotten. It has been many years since I fled that place on board a plane, inside a suitcase made of soft black leather, never to return. I have since adopted another land, England, where I have grown and thrived, but not a single day passes that I do not yearn to be back. Home, motherland. It must still be there where I left it, rising and sinking with the waves that break in foam upon its rugged coastline, at the crossroads of three continents, Europe, Africa, Asia, and the Levant, that vast and impenetrable region vanished entirely from the maps of today. A map is a two-dimensional representation with arbitrary symbols and incised lines that decide who is to be our enemy and who is to be our friend, who deserves our love and who deserves our hatred, and who our sheer indifference. Cartography is another name for stories told by winners. For stories told by those who have lost, there isn't one. Here is how I remember it. Golden beaches, turquoise waters, lucid skies. Every year, sea turtles would come ashore to lay their eggs in the powdery sand. The late afternoon wind brought along the scent of gardenia, cyclamen, lavender, honeysuckle. Branching ropes of wisteria climbed up whitewashed walls, aspiring to reach the clouds, hopeful, in the way only dreamers are. When the night kissed your skin, as it always did, you could smell the jasmine on its breath. The moon, here, closer to earth, hung bright and gentle over the rooftops, casting a vivid glow on the narrow alleys and the cobblestone streets. And yet, shadows found a way to creep through the light. Whispers of distrust and conspiracy rippled in the dark. For the island was riven into two pieces, the north and the south. A different language, a different script, a different memory prevailed in each. And when they prayed, the islanders, it was seldom to the same god. The capital was split by a partition which sliced right through it like a slash to the heart. Along the demarcation line, the frontier, were dilapidated houses riddled with bullet holes, empty courtyards scarred with grenade bursts, boarded stores gone to ruin, ornamented gates hanging at angles from broken hinges, luxury cars from another era rusting away under layers of dust. Roads were blocked by coils of barbed wire, piles of sandbags, barrels full of concrete, anti-tank ditches and watchtowers. Streets ended abruptly, like unfinished thoughts and unresolved feelings. Soldiers stood guard with machine guns when they were not making the rounds. Young, bored, lonesome men from various corners of the world who had known little about the island and its complex history until they found themselves posted to this unfamiliar environment. Walls were plastered with official signs in bold colours and capital letters. No entry beyond this point. Keep away, restricted area. No photographs, no filming allowed. Then, further along the barricade, an illicit addition in chalk scribbled on a barrel by a passerby. Welcome, to no man's land. The partition that tore through Cyprus from one end to the other, a buffer zone patrolled by United Nations troops, was about 110 miles long and as wide as 4 miles in some places, while merely a few yards in others. It traversed all kinds of landscapes, abandoned villages, coastal hinterlands, wetlands, fallow lands, pine forests, fertile plains, copper mines, and archaeological sites, meandering in its course like the ghost of some ancient river. But it was here, across and around the capital, that it became more visible, tangible, and thus haunting. Nicosia, the only divided capital in the world. It sounded almost a positive thing when described that way. Something special about it, if not unique. A sense of defying gravity, like the single grain of sand moving skywards in an hourglass just appended. But, in reality, Nicosia was no exception. One more name added to the list of segregated places and separated communities. Those consigned to history, and those yet to come. At this moment, though, it stood as a peculiarity. The last divided city in Europe. My hometown. There are many things that a border, even one as clear-cut and well-guarded as this one, cannot prevent from crossing. The Etesian wind, for instance. The softly named but surprisingly strong Meltemi or Meltem. The butterflies, grasshoppers and lizards. The snails too, painfully slow though they are. Occasionally a birthday balloon that escapes a child's grip drifts in the sky, strays into the other side, enemy territory. Then the birds, blue herons, black-headed buntings, honey buzzards, yellow wagtails, willow warblers, mast shrikes, and my favourites, golden orioles. All the way from the northern hemisphere, migrating mostly during the night, darkness gathering at the tips of their wings and etching red circles around their eyes. They stop here midway in their long journey before continuing to Africa. The island for them is a resting place, a lacuna in the tail, an in-betweenness. There is a hill in Nicosia where birds of all plumages come to forage and feed. It is thick with overgrown brambles, stinging nettles, and clumps of heather. In the midst of this dense vegetation is an old well with a pulley that creaks at the slightest tug and a metal bucket tied to a rope, frayed and algae-covered from disuse. Deep inside, it's always pitch black and freezing cold, even in the fierce midday sun beating down directly overhead. The well is a hungry mouth, awaiting its next meal. It eats up every ray of light, every trace of heat, holding each mote in its elongated stone throat. If you ever find yourself in the area, and if, led by curiosity or instinct, you lean over the edge and peer down, waiting for your eyes to adjust, you may catch a glint below, like the fleeting gleam from the scales of a fish, just before it disappears back into the water. Do not let that deceive you, though. There are no fish down there. No snakes, no scorpions, no spiders dangling from silken threads. The glint does not come from a living being, but from an antique pocket watch. 18-karat gold, encased with mother of pearl, engraved with lines from a poem. Arriving there is what you are destined for, but do not hurry the journey at all. And then, on the back are two letters, or more precisely, the same letter written twice. Why and why? The well is 34 feet deep and 4 feet wide. It is constructed of gently curved ashlar stone, descending in identical horizontal courses all the way down to the mute and musty waters below. Trapped at the bottom are two men, the owners of a popular tavern. Both of slender build and medium height, with large, jutting ears, which they used to joke about. Both born and bred on this island and in their 40s, when they were kidnapped, beaten, and murdered. They have been thrown into the shaft after being chained first to each other, then to a 3-liter olive tin filled with concrete to ensure they will never surface again. The pocket watch that one of them wore on the day of their abduction has stopped at exactly 8 minutes to midnight. Time is a songbird, and just like any other songbird, it can be taken captive. It can be held prisoner in a cage, and for even longer than you might think possible. But time cannot be kept in check in perpetuity. No captivity is forever. Someday, the water will rust away the metal and the chains will snap, and the concrete's rigid heart will soften, as even the most rigid hearts tend to do with the passing of the years. Only then will the two corpses, finally free, swim towards the chink of sky overhead, shimmering in the reflected sunlight. They would ascend towards the blissful blue, at first slowly, then fast and frantic, like pearl divers gasping for air. Sooner or later, this old, dilapidated well on that lonely, beautiful island at the far end of the Mediterranean Sea will collapse in on itself, and its secret will rise to the surface, as every secret is bound to do in the end. Part 1. How to Bury a Tree. A girl named Island. England, late 2010s. It was the last lesson of the year at Brookhill Secondary School in North London, Year 11 classroom, history lesson. Only 15 minutes before the bell, and the students were getting restless, eager for the Christmas holidays to start. All the students, that is, except for one. Ada Kazantzakis, aged 16, sat with a quiet intensity in her usual seat by the window at the back of the classroom. Her hair, the colour of burnished mahogany, was gathered in a low-slung ponytail. Her delicate features were drawn and tight, and her large doe eyes seemed to betray a lack of sleep the night before. She was neither looking forward to the festive season, nor feeling any excitement at the prospect of snowfall. Every now and then she cast furtive glances outside, though her expression remained mostly unchanged. Around midday, it had hailed. Milky white, frozen pellets shredding the last of the leaves in the trees, hammering the bicycle shed roof, bouncing off the ground in a wild tap dance. Now, it had fallen quiet. But anyone could see the weather had turned decisively worse. A storm was on its way. This morning, the radio had announced that with no more than 48 hours, Britain would be hit by a polar vortex, bringing in record-breaking lows, icy rains, and blizzards. Water shortages, power cuts, and burst mains were expected to paralyze large swathes of England and Scotland as well, and parts of Northern Europe. People had been stockpiling canned fish, baked beans, bags of pasta, toilet paper, as if getting ready for a siege. All day long, the students had been carrying on about the storm, worried for their holiday plans and travel arrangements. Not Ada, though. She had neither family gatherings nor exotic destinations lined up. Her father did not intend to go anywhere. He had work to do. He always had work to do. Her father was an incurable workaholic. Anyone who knew him would testify to that. But ever since her mother had died, he had retreated into his research like a burrowing animal hiding in its tunnel for safety and warmth. Somewhere in the course of her young life, Ada had understood that he was very different from other fathers. But she still found it hard to take kindly to his obsession with plants. Everyone else's fathers worked in offices, shops, or government departments, wore matching suits, white shirts, and polished black shoes. Whereas hers was usually clad in a waterproof jacket, a pair of olive or brown moleskin trousers, and rugged boots. Instead of a briefcase, he had a shoulder bag that carried miscellaneous items like his hand lens, dissecting kit, plant press, compass, and notebooks. Other fathers endlessly prattled on about business and retirement plans, but hers was more interested in the toxic effects of pesticides on seed germination or ecological damage from logging. He spoke about the impact of deforestation with a passion his counterparts reserved for fluctuations in their personal stock portfolios. Not only spoke, but wrote about it too. An evolutionary ecologist and botanist, he had published 12 books. One of them was called The Mysterious Kingdom: How Fungi Shaped Our Past, Changes Our Future. Another one of his monographs was about hornworts, liverworts, and mosses. The cover depicted a stone bridge over a creek bubbling across rocks, coated in velvety green. Right above the dreamlike image was the gilded title: A Field Guide to Common Bryophytes of Europe. Underneath, his name was printed in capital letters: Kostas Kazantzakis. Ada had no idea what kind of people would read the sort of books her father wrote, but she hadn't dared mention them to anyone at school. She had no intention of giving her classmates yet another reason to conclude that she and her family were weird. No matter the time of day, her father seemed to prefer the company of trees to the company of humans. He had always been this way. But when her mother was alive, she could temper his eccentricities, possibly because she too had her own peculiar ways. Since her death, Ada had felt her father drifting away from her. Or perhaps it was she who had been drifting away from him. It was hard to tell who was evading whom in a house engulfed in a miasma of grief. So they would be at home, the two of them, not only for the duration of the storm, but the entire Christmas season. Ada hoped her father had remembered to go shopping. Her eyes slid down to the notebook. On the open page at the bottom, she had sketched a butterfly. Slowly, she traced the wings, so brittle, easily breakable. "Hey, got any gum?" Snapping out of her reverie, Ada turned aside. She liked sitting at the back of the classroom, but that meant being paired off with Emma Rose, who had that annoying habit of cracking her knuckles, chewing one piece of gum after another, although it was not allowed at school, and had a tendency to go on about matters that were of no interest to anyone else. "No, sorry." Ada shook her head and glanced nervously at the teacher. "History is a most fascinating subject," Mrs. Walcott was now saying, her brogues planted firmly behind her desk, as though she needed a barricade from behind which to teach her students, all 29 of them. "Without understanding our past, how can we hope to shape our future?" "Oh, I can't stand her," Emma Rose muttered under her breath. Ada did not comment. She wasn't sure whether Emma Rose had meant her or the teacher. If the former, she had nothing to say in her own defense. If the latter, she wasn't going to join in the vilification. She liked Mrs. Walcott, who, though well-meaning, clearly had difficulty keeping discipline in the classroom. Ada had heard that the woman had lost her husband a few years back. She had pictured in her mind more than a few times what her teacher's daily life must be like. how she dragged her round body out of bed in the mornings, rushed to take a shower before the hot water ran out, rummaged in a wardrobe for a suitable dress, hardly different from yesterday's suitable dress, whipped up breakfast for her twins before dropping them off at the nursery, her face flushed, her tone apologetic. She had also imagined her teacher touching herself at night, her hands drawing circles under a cotton nightie, and at times inviting in men who would leave wet footprints on the carpet and a sourness in her soul. Ada had no idea whether her thoughts corresponded with reality, but she suspected so. It was her talent, perhaps, her only one. She could detect other people's sadness the way one animal could smell another of its kind a mile away. "All right, class, one final note before you go," Mrs. Walcott said with a clap of her hands. "We'll be studying migrating and generational change next term. It's a nice fun project before we knuckle down and get on with GCSE revision. In preparation, I want you to identify an elderly relative during the holidays. Ideally your grandparents, but it could just as well be another family member. Ask them questions about what it was like when they were young and come up with a 4-to-5-page essay." A chorus of unhappy sighs rippled across the room. "Make sure your writing is supported by historical facts," Mrs. Walcott said, ignoring the reaction. "I want to see solid research backed up by evidence, not speculation." More sighs and groans followed. "Oh, don't forget to check if there are any heirlooms around, an antique ring, a wedding dress, a set of vintage china, a handmade quilt, a box of letters or family recipes, any memorabilia that has been passed down." Ada dropped her gaze. She had never met her relatives on either side. She knew they lived in Cyprus somewhere, but that was about the extent of her knowledge. What kind of people were they? How did they spend their days? Would they recognize her if they passed her by on the street or bumped into each other at the supermarket? The only close relation she had heard of was a certain Aunt Miriam, who sent cheerful postcards of sunny beaches and wildflower pastures that jarred with her complete lack of presence in their lives. If her relatives remained a mystery, Cyprus was a bigger one. She had seen pictures on the internet, but she had not once travelled to the place after which she was named. In her mother's language, her name meant island. When she was younger, she had assumed it referred to Great Britain, the only island she had ever known. Only later coming to realize that it was in fact another island, far away. And the reason was that she was conceived over there. The discovery had left her with a sense of confusion, if not discomfort. Firstly, because it reminded her that her parents had had sex, something she never wanted to think about. Secondly, because it attached her in an inevitable way to a place that hitherto had existed only in her imagination. Since then, she had added her own name to the collection of non-English words to carry in her pockets. Words which, though curious and colourful, still felt distant and unfamiliar enough to remain impenetrable. Like perfect pebbles you picked up on a beach and brought home, but then didn't know what to do with. She had quite a few of them by now. Some idioms too, and songs, merry tunes. But that was about it. Her parents had not taught her their native languages, preferring to communicate solely in English at home. Ada could speak neither her father's Greek nor her mother's Turkish. Growing up, each time she had inquired why they had not yet been to Cyprus to meet their relatives, or why their relatives had not come to visit them in England, both her mother and father had given her a whole host of excuses. The time just wasn't right. There was too much work to be done or too many expenses to take care of. Slowly, a suspicion had taken root inside her. Maybe her parents' marriage had not been approved by the families. In that case, she surmised, nor was she, a product of their marriage, really approved. Yet for as long as she was able to, Ada retained the hopeful belief that if any of her extended family were to spend time with her and her parents, they would forgive them for whatever it was that they had not been forgiven for. Since her mother's death, however, Ada had stopped asking questions about her next of kin. If they were the kind of people who would not attend her mother's funeral, of one of their own, they were hardly likely to have any love for the child of the deceased, a girl they had never laid eyes on. "While you conduct your interview, do not judge the older generation," said Mrs. Walcott. "Listen carefully. Try to see things through their eyes, and make sure to record the entire conversation." Jason, sitting in the front row, interjected. "So if we interview a Nazi criminal, shall we be nice to them?" Mrs. Walcott sighed. "Well, that's a bit of an extreme example, no. No, I don't expect you to be nice to that sort of person." Jason grinned as if he had scored a point. "Miss," Emma Rose chimed in, "we've got an antique violin at home. Would that count as an heirloom?" "Sure, if it's something that belonged to your family for generations." "Oh yes, we've had it for so long," Emma beamed. "My mother says it was made in Vienna in the 19th century. Or was it the 18th? Anyway, it's very valuable, but we're not selling it." Zafar put his hand up. "We've got a hope chest that belonged to my granny. She brought it with her from Punjab. Would that do?" Ada felt her heart give a little thud, not even hearing the teacher's response to the rest of the conversation. Her whole frame went rigid as she tried not to look at Zafar, lest her face give away her feelings. The month before, the two of them had unexpectedly been paired up for a science project, assembling a device to measure how many calories different types of food contained. After days of trying to coordinate a meeting and failing, she had given up and done most of the research herself, finding articles, buying the kit, building the calorimeter. They had both received an A at the end. A tiny smile forming at the corner of his mouth, Zafar had thanked her with an awkwardness that could have been a guilty conscience, but which might equally have been indifference. It was the last time they had spoken. Ada had never kissed a boy. All the girls in a year had something to tell, real or imaginary, when they gathered in the changing rooms before and after PE. But not her. This absolute silence of hers has not gone unnoticed, provoking much ribbing and ridicule. Once she'd found a porn magazine inside a school bag, slipped in by unknown hands, she was certain to freak her out. All day long she had agonized that a teacher might spot it and inform her father. Not that she was scared of her father the way she knew some of the other students were of theirs. It wasn't fear that she felt, not even guilt, after having decided to keep the magazine. That wasn't the reason why she had not told him about the incident, or about other incidents. She had stopped sharing things with her father ever since she sensed, on some primal level, that she needed to protect him from more pain. If her mother were alive, Ada might have shown her the magazine. They might have looked at it together, giggling. They might have talked, cradling mugs of hot chocolate in their hands, breathing in the steam that rose towards their faces. Her mother had understood unruly thoughts, naughty jokes, the dark side of the moon. She once said, half jokingly, that she was too rebellious to be a good mum, and too motherly to be a good rebel. Only now, after she had gone, did Ada acknowledge that despite everything, she was a good mom and a good rebel. It had been exactly 11 months and 8 days since her death. This would be the first Christmas she would spend without her. "What do you think, Ada?" Mrs. Walcott asked suddenly. "Would you agree with that?" Having gone back to her drawing, it took Ada another beat to shift her gaze from the butterfly and realize that the teacher was looking at her. Blushing up to her hairline, her back tensed as if her body had sensed a danger she was yet to comprehend. When she found her voice, it came out so shaky she wasn't sure she had spoken at all. "Pardon? I was asking whether you think Jason is right." "Sorry, miss. Right about what?" Suppressed titter rose from the classroom. "We were talking about family heirlooms," said Mrs. Walcott with a tired smile. Zafar mentioned his grandma's hope chest. Then Jason said, "Why is it always women who cling to their souvenirs and knick-knacks from the past?" "And I wanted to know whether you agree with that statement." Ada swallowed dryly. Her pulse thudded in her temples. Silence, thick and glutinous, trickled into the space around her. She imagined it spreading out like dark ink onto crocheted white doilies, like the ones she had once found in the drawer of her mother's dressing table. Neatly cut into obsessively small pieces, destroyed. They had been placed between layers of tissue paper as if her mother could neither keep them as they were nor bring herself to destroy them and throw them away. "Any thoughts?" said Mrs. Walcott, her voice tender but insistent. Slowly, and without thinking why, Ada stood up, scraping the chair noisily against the flagstone floor. She cleared her throat, though she had absolutely no idea what to say. Her mind had gone blank. On the open page in front of her, the butterfly, alarmed and desperate to flee, took to the air, even though its wings, unfinished and blurred at the edges, were hardly strong enough. I don't think it's always women. My father does it too.
He does?
Asked Mrs. Walcott. How exactly? Now all her classmates were staring at her, waiting for her to say something that would make sense. Someone had a gentle pity in their eyes. Others had a crude indifference, which she much preferred. She felt unmoored by this collective expectation, pressure building in her ears as if she was sinking underwater.
"Can you give us an example?" said Mrs. Walcott. "What does your father collect?"
"My father," Ada said and paused. What could she tell them about him? That he forgot to eat or even speak sometimes? Letting whole days go by without consuming proper food or uttering a full sentence? Or that if only he could, he would probably spend the rest of his life in the back garden, or better yet, in a forest somewhere, his hands plunged in the soil, surrounded by bacteria, fungi, and all those plants growing and decaying by the minute. What could she tell them about her father that would make them understand what he was like when she herself had a hard time recognizing him anymore? Instead, she said a single word. Plants.
Plants? Echoed Mrs. Walcott, her face twisted with incomprehension.
My father is fond of them, Ada added in a rush, instantly regretting her choice of words.
Oh, how cute. He fancies flowers, Jason commented in a syrupy tone.
Laughter rippled through the classroom, no longer constrained. Ada noticed that even her friend Ed was avoiding her gaze, pretending to notice and to read something in the textbook, his shoulders slumped and his head down. She then searched for Zafar and found his bright black eyes that rarely saw her, now studying her with a curiosity that bordered on concern.
Well, that's lovely, said Mrs. Walcott. But can you think of an object he cares about? Something that has emotional value?
In that moment, there was nothing Ada wanted more than to find the right words. Why were they hiding from her? Her stomach constricted with a stab of pain so sharp that for a few seconds she thought she couldn't breathe, let alone talk. And yet she did. And when she did, she heard herself say, "He spends a lot of time with his trees." Mrs. Walcott gave a half nod, her smile fading from her lips.
"Especially this fig tree. I think it's his favorite."
"That's right. All right then, you may sit down now," said Mrs. Walcott. But Ada did not comply. The pain, having darted towards her ribcage, was searching for a way out. Her chest tightened as though squeezed by invisible hands. She felt disorientated, the room swaying slightly under her feet.
God, she's so cringy, someone whispered loud enough for her to hear. Ada clenched her eyes shut, feeling the burn of the comment, a raw scorch mark on her flesh. But nothing they did or said could be worse than a hatred for herself just then. What was wrong with her? Why could she not answer a simple question like everyone else? As a child, she had loved turning in circles on the Turkish carpet to make herself dizzy and drop to the floor, from where she could watch the world spin round and round. She could still remember the hand-woven patterns of the carpet dissolving in a thousand sparks, the colours blending into each other, scarlet into green, saffron into white. But what she experienced right now was a different kind of dizziness. She had the sense of entering a trap, a door locking behind her, the click of a latch falling into place. She felt paralyzed. So many times in the past, she had suspected that she carried within a sadness that was not quite her own. In science class, they had learned that everyone inherited one chromosome from their mother and one from their father, long threads of DNA with thousands of genes that built billions of neurons and trillions of connections between them. All that genetic information passed from parent to offspring. Survival, growth, reproduction, the color of your hair, the shape of your nose, whether you had freckles or you sneezed in the sunlight, everything wasn't there. But none of that answered the one question burning in her mind. Was it also possible to inherit something as intangible and immeasurable as sorrow? You may sit down, repeated Mrs. Walcott. Still, she did not move. Ada, did you not hear what I said? Remaining upright, she tried to choke back the fear that filled her throat and clogged her nostrils. It reminded her of the taste of the sea under a harsh beating sun. She touched it with the tip of her tongue. It wasn't the salty sea brine after all. It was warm blood. She had been biting the inside of her cheek. Her eyes slid towards the window beyond which the storm was approaching. She noticed in the slate-grey sky amidst banks of clouds a sliver of crimson bleeding into the horizon, like an old wound that had never quite healed. Please sit down, came the teacher's voice. And once again, she did not comply. Later, much later, when the worst had already happened and she was alone in her bed at night, unable to fall asleep, listening to her father, also sleepless, pacing the house, Ada Kazantzakis would revisit this moment. This fissure in time, when she could have done as she was told and returned to her seat, remaining more or less invisible to everyone in the classroom, unnoticed but also undisturbed. She could have kept things the way they had been, if only she could have stopped herself from doing what she did next.